Thank you, dear listener, for tuning into Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of Panopticon Podcast. Our guest tonight is Dr. Johan Galtung. Dr. Galtung is a Norwegian professor and author, widely regarded as the father of academic peace research. His pioneering and continuing efforts have greatly contributed to inspiring the creation of peace and conflict resolution academic programs in universities throughout the world. In an academic career spanning 40 years, Johan Galtung has been a visiting professor at 30 schools on 5 different continents. He has written more than 100 books and over 1,000 articles about peace and conflict resolution, ecology, health, global governance, sustainable development, and economic reform. In 1959, he started the International Peace Research Institute in Oslo and directed it for 10 years. In 1964, he launched the Journal for Peace Research at the University of Oslo. In 1993, he co-founded Transcend, a peace and development network for conflict transformation by peaceful means, which has members in more than 50 countries. In 1987, Johan Galtung received the Right Livelihood Award, often referred to as the Alternative Nobel Prize, for his systematic and multidisciplinary study of the conditions which can lead to peace. And now, the interview with Dr. Johan Galtung. Okay, we have on the line with us Mr. Johan Galtung. Can you please give us a little bit of your background before we get into your work?
Well, I'm a peace researcher and have been working on that for more than 50 years. So my background is, in terms of PhD, it's one in mathematics and one in sociology, and I have about 150 books out by now.
Okay.
And a lot of mediation in international and national, and incidentally also marital conflicts around the world.
And you recently released a book entitled The Fall of the U.S. Empire and Then What? Successors, Regionalization or Globalization, U.S. Fascism or U.S. Blossoming. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that's one of the recent books. Been working on it for some time. I've always been fascinated with the decline of empires. See, an empire is a sort of an organism, and it has a birth, in the U.S. case, around 1898 as international empire. On the U.S. mainland, it started much, much before that, of course. And then blossomed very quickly, walking into the shoes of the dying Spanish empire. And my prediction is that it will die before 2020. Because you see, what happens is that empires blossom and they reach a full maturity. And they get intoxicated with themselves. They don't sense moderation. It's not overexpanding territorially. That's only one little factor. The point is that they're accumulating all kinds of problems, contradictions, as we call them, resistance, disobedience, people who think they can do things better without the empire, all kinds of things come up. And in the end, they die mainly, as T.S. Eliot says, not with a bang, but with a whimper. They die because they're not able to handle all the problems that come up. They're simply too numerous, too diverse. And what happens then is demoralization. Now, a typical example of demoralization is what you see in the U.S. right now, with McChrystal reporting his sentiments to a music magazine.
Yeah.
And Petraeus fainting in front of a Senate committee. So McChrystal is fired and Petraeus is his successor. And I can only say, I know from my comparative studies of the fall of empires how this is going to work, or rather not work.
Can you talk to us about the most intriguing ideas of yours to me is this distinction that you make between the U.S. empire and the U.S. republic.
Well, you see, I used to say when I give talks about this in the U.S., I've been professor at Columbia, Princeton, University of Hawaii, Duke University, and so on and so on. So I'm fairly well at home. I used to put my hands on the heart and say I love the U.S. Republic and I hate the U.S. Empire. And the love for the U.S. Republic is for a country with enormous amounts of problems and enormous amounts of successes. Oh, fantastically innovative, generous, often very, very far-reaching, fine people. And of course the opposite, like you have in all countries. The empire sees evil as a major source of evil. It kills, 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 exploits and starves all over the world. And passed in terms of warfare the Roman Empire in the early 90s. So I had people coming up to me after that kind of talk with tears in their eyes, saying that it was very liberating what I said, because they love their country, but at the same time disagree profoundly with U.S. foreign policy and other things that the U.S. does abroad. And then they hear me saying, you can distinguish between the two, you can love one and hate the other. Not drawing the line too clearly, of course one goes into the other, but nevertheless there's a distinction. And that leads to the obvious conclusion. Dear United States of America, get rid of the empire, it's an albatross around your neck. You will swim much better without.
Well, I know that hearing that from you meant a lot to me when I first heard it on Democracy Now, because I had always struggled with that for many years now, of being able to distance the things I loved about my country from the things I hated about my country. So thank you so much for putting it so clearly, because it does mean a lot to me as well as an American.
Well, that's kind of you to say, Andy, and that's exactly what I hope. And as you say, I put it clearly, maybe a little bit too clearly, but that is useful. I mean, when we distinguish between men and women, we know perfectly well there are all kinds of in-betweens and double things and zero things and so on. Yet, it's a very useful distinction. And the U.S. Republic could do extremely well, could blossom.
Do you think that the fall of the U.S. Empire would harm the U.S. Republic in a way that would be too great for it to live on, in a way that would be healthy and vigorous?
Well, that's a question very much discussed in the book. And you can say that you have two extreme scenarios. To get rid of the empire doesn't mean a declaration. It simply means that you stop invading other countries.
Yeah.
You may have a strong defense at home so that anybody who should invade will get, let us call it, a warm welcome. But you stop invading. You stop manipulating, arms twisting. Go in for honest negotiation. You stop thinking that you have the solution to everything. You go more in for dialogue. And you stop the idea that you can just exploit people all around the world with twisted deals. And you go in for deals that are more symmetric, more mutual, more equal. Now, how then will the U.S. Republic react to that? And in the book, I have two scenarios, and one is a military coup. And the other one is blossoming. Now, the military coup would be for the hard nucleus who are not going to let the empire go. And the hard nucleus would probably today be identified with evangelical generals in the Pentagon. There are many of them. With a hardcore CIA, if you assume there are two CIAs, a soft one and a harder one, and a hardcore linking up with those evangelical generals. And they will, of course, do it in the name of Christianity and Western civilization in order to keep U.S. hegemony. The problem with that formula is that what the U.S. is doing now, and the reason why they attract some allies, is that it is in the name of democracy. And if that democracy is yielding to a military takeover, they would lose almost all of their allies overnight. Now, they may be fanatic enough to try to do it alone, and they might even use nuclear weapons for that purpose, especially according to the new doctrine, named that first strike is possible from the U.S. side to countries that have nuclear weapons and countries who are not certified nuclear-free, meaning in clear writing, according to the U.S., North Korea and Iran. But then you see you have just the opposite. And the opposite scenario would be millions of Americans taking this as a new chance to get the ship launched and restarted. and you would see them working hard, locally, all over the place, getting decent savings banks operating, liberating funds for stimulus, getting cooperative work structures, more than the old-fashioned U.S. highly vertical, highly exploitative company. You could see them using the municipalities as a basis for a new, more decentralized America. You could even see Tea Party people and more progressive people holding hands on that issue. You would have problems. The, if you will, very, very important amendment number 2 to the Constitution on the right to bear arms could lead to some shootings here and there, which would have the character of local civil wars. But I think by and large, reason would prevail. So this is a scenario more for grassroots America, and the first one, the evangelical general takeover. And you will keep in mind that one of the last things Bush did was to see to it that as many generals in Pentagon as possible were evangelicals. 2 scenarios, one at the bottom, one at the top. Well, I frankly speaking don't know which one will prevail. Of course my heart is with the grassroots one, the one from the bottom, the blossoming one. And I think in the longer run, that one will prevail.
Okay, great. I'd like to ask you the $64,000 question, which is, what do we do in Iraq right now? How do we resolve the giant rift we've incurred upon that country, and how do we leave and solve that conflict?
Well, Iraq and Afghanistan are similar in the sense that there is no solution compatible with having U.S. forces staying and with having U.S. bases left behind, manned by U.S. forces. On the other hand, if the U.S. forces leave and the bases are not there, Iraqis will take the things in their own hands and Afghanis will take the things in their own hands. And what they will do is not necessarily what the U.S. had planned. One has to be prepared for that. And here, of course, the example is Vietnam. U.S. left, 30 April 1975, left, tried to make it look like it was not a losing face and losing faith. Anyhow, the Vietnamese took over and managed to build a very crafty, dynamic dragon, if you will, society. It has its ups and downs, like everything has economically these days. By and large, have succeeded very well. If I should make a guess as to Iraq and Afghanistan, after the absolutely indispensable, necessary, but not sufficient U.S. withdrawal, it would be either a very loose federation or a confederation. It would divide, it would split up into 3 parts. Since Iraq is a totally artificial construction, constructed in 1916 by the English Foreign Ministry, and the 3 parts will, of course, be the Kurdish, the Sunni, and the Shia. The Kurdish and the Shia have oil, the Sunni do not. They are 4 of the 18 provinces. And not unproblematic, it may be that the so-called international community will have to support them. I think this will work itself out. And even if it is not in the U.S. game plan, it will be to the best in the longer run. And as to Afghanistan, there will be Taliban in the government. They will not lay down any arms before the foreign troops are out. That means not only U.S. troops. They will probably go for a very decentralized Afghanistan with Kabul as one sort of provincial city. There might be a capital even somewhere else. But Kabul is hated. Karzai is to a large extent hated. And anybody who tries to rule Afghanistan out of Kabul using Karzai as their instrument is hated even more, is my experience. So having said that, I would guess one third thing, in addition to coalition government to the Taliban and a heavy decentralization, a central Asian community of Afghanistan with all its neighbors. The borders are totally artificial, coming out of Western colonialism in various ways, incidentally including Russian. So they would probably like to relate to the 5 Central Asian Muslim republics that were in the Soviet Union formerly, to Iran and Pakistan, and to the Muslim part of Kashmir. Now, this will be very strong. And The organization working for that would be the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, headed by China and Russia. In short, we had a kind of situation where the U.S. is maneuvering so badly, it can neither win nor capitulate. It can, of course, withdraw. It cannot participate in conflict resolution because it doesn't have any concepts of that. What is left for the U.S. is irrelevant, just like in Vietnam. The Vietnamese did their thing, the Iraqis will do their thing, and the Afghans will do their thing. And the U.S. will withdraw and hopefully very soon give up this kind of adventure.
Very well. As I mentioned in an email to you, I am an English teacher in South Korea. And obviously things have been heating up quite a bit between the South and the North after the sinking of the warship. And I was wondering if you could speak about this conflict.
Okay, I can say a couple of words as an ending. I've been working on it since 1972. I don't think there will be any unification of the two Koreas. There will be a unification of the nation in the sense of cooperation and relatively open borders. Right now we have a particularly bad period. And I would say that most of it is due. And most of it is located in the conflict, not between North and South Korea, but between North Korea and the United States of America. And the USA's failure to enter diplomatic relations and to sign a peace treaty and to normalize relations, all the time hoping that North Korea will collapse. Now, if North Korea is at the brink of collapse, I don't think collapsing countries are capable of making missiles or making nuclear weapons, atomic bombs, fairly complex operations. So there's a kind of contradiction bordering on stupidity in the U.S. thinking. Now, the ship. I don't know what the ship was about. I think it would be very important to have had the North Koreans in on the commission and get their assessment of it. I hear something about rusty propeller, about the possibility that it was an overlaid mine from the Korean War. I hear much about the insignia indicating North Korean participation, or that it came from North Korea, being sort of freshly painted. I'm not in a position to evaluate anything of that. I don't know. I would also imagine that there would be all kinds of rumors about an event like this. Of course, everybody knows about the disputed zone, whether you base it on the 38th parallel or the armistice line. In other words, which line you draw into the ocean and you get a sizable sector. And that, of course, was very important in the shootout in December, if I'm not too wrong. And in that case, the shooting came from the South Koreans. So the question now is whether this was revenge, whether it was a mistake, whether it was North Korean at all. Somebody is saying that could have been a U.S. provocation. I don't necessarily believe in that. But I am saying that unless you have a bona fide U.N. commission working on it, and not one basically appointed by South Korea, we will not be able to put that case to rest. In the meantime, all I can say is that as long as the relation between North Korea and U.S. is not sorted out, there will be no progress.
Okay. Do you have time for one more quick question?
That would be not a question or a quick question, but a quick answer. Go ahead.
Okay. What type of role can religion play in the mediation or creation of conflicts?
The quick question would be this. It's not a question of which religion. You see, all religions come in a sort of hard reading and soft reading. A hard, tough version, like the Islam of an Osama bin Laden. But then you have the Islam of Sufism, extremely soft. Or the Christianity of a Reagan or a Bush, talking about evil, and always having the evil far away from themselves. As opposed to the Quakers, the Mennonites, the Anabaptists, and so on. So it can be for the good, under the idea that we are all sons and daughters of God, that we are all united under the same sky, or under the idea that this world is strongly divided between good and evil, and resist evil by all means, and the good has to be united, construct alliances, and so on. In the Western world, hard Christianity has been dominating. In Islam, hard Islam is now coming up. It has not been understood that it was soft for a long time. The heart is now being strengthened, and I would say to a large extent, by what comes from the West.
Thank you very much, Dr. Galtung. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. You're so welcome, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for your
Thank
work.
Thank you so much indeed. Bye then.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And thus ends episode 9 of Panopticon Podcast. Again, we thank Dr. Johan Galtung for taking the time out of his very busy schedule to speak with us. And we thank you, dear listener, for tuning in and listening once again. Have a great night. Peace.